2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 351, The Many Voices of Brigham Young. Participants, artist E. Parshall and Newell G. Bringhurst.
Artist says she is independently engaged in genealogical and historical research, never been broker, and never been happier. She is self-taught with the help of a lot of generous mentors, including Bill McKinnon, Will Bagley, and the staff of LDS Archives. Whether she has any published books or articles, she says, ask me again in 5 years. So, she lives in Orem, Utah, and she will be giving the paper. And then we have Newell G. Bringhurst. He is an instructor of history and political science at the College of the Sequoias, author of Brigham Young and the Expanding Mormon Frontier. That's this book right here. He's also the author of Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, and you may be revising this one. He has some other books that he's written. There's five total, and then he is completing a group of graphical essays with Greg Foster that will be entitled probably Expanding Mormon Vistas. Yeah. Is that correct? And we will go from there. So go ahead. And
In February 1855, Thomas Bullock stood in the Tabernacle in Salt Lake City and read a discourse dictated by Brigham Young. It was a lengthy speech outlining the position of the Mormon people with regard to the Constitution of the United States, the administration of its laws, the election and appointment of its officials, and the history of the Church in relation to American law and politics. The subject was a volatile one, given past conflicts and the then-current very real possibility that Brigham Young would be replaced as governor by Colonel E.J. Steptoe, whose large army detachment was disrupting the social and civil peace of Salt Lake City. The prepared speech strongly defended Mormon political rights and warned that the people would not submit tamely to abuses of power. Yet it was carefully worded, avoiding personal remarks against specific officers or inflammatory calls to action beyond the scrupulous practice of the people's religion. It should be the aim of all good citizens, and it is our intention and design as a people, to promote virtue, intelligence, and patriotism. Should not those officers who have been sent among us by the United States be an example in point of morality, virtue, and good behavior? I believe it is legal to exercise all the power and influence which God has given me for the preservation of virtue, truth, and holiness. This, then, is our position towards the government of the United States and towards the world, to put down iniquity and exalt virtue, to declare the word of God which he revealed unto us and build up his kingdom upon the earth. At the conclusion of these remarks, as read by his clerk, Brigham Young stood and said, "In my conversation, I shall talk and act as I please. Still, I am always aware when speaking in public that there are those present who are disposed to find fault with this people and to try to raise a prejudice against them. And they will pick up isolated words and sentences and put them together to suit themselves and send forth a garbled version to prejudice the world against us. Such a course I never care anything about. For, I have frequently said, spoken words are but wind, and when they are spoken are gone. Consequently, I take liberties in speaking which I do not allow when I commit my sentiments to writing." He then delivered a second discourse, every bit as long and detailed as his prepared remarks and on the same subjects. His extemporaneous speech was much less measured than his written words, however. "Brethren and sisters, our friends wish to know our feelings towards the government. I answer, they are first rate. We love the Constitution of the country. Now I will tell you one thing that I am opposed to, and that this people are opposed to. It is to a man a coming here as an officer with a bit of sheepskin in his pocket and saying, 'I am a gentleman. I am a high-minded gentleman. Can you tell me where I can find a woman to sleep with me tonight? Let them intrude upon the chastity of my family, and so help me God, I will use them up.' Such characters may cry, 'Aliens, aliens! The Mormons are all hostile to the government,' and they may cry it until they are in hell." "I take liberties in speaking," he said, "which I do not allow when I commit my sentiments to writing." Through the pens of his multiple clerks, he was not much given to writing himself, Brigham Young committed thousands of pages of his sentiments to writing. Much of this material is part of the Brigham Young collection housed in the archives of the LDS Church, with large parts of the collection newly available to the public. Taking advantage of this new accessibility, I have spent the past few months exploring the incoming and, to a lesser extent, the outgoing correspondence in this collection. Having previously been familiar with Brigham Young, chiefly through the fiery rhetoric that historians and critics love to quote, I was struck repeatedly by the variety of tone in his letters written to bishops and soldiers, lonely saints and angry politicians, absent sons, fur trappers, Indians, and autograph seekers. These letters were written to comfort, to discomfort, to reassure, to conduct business, to persuade, and to irritate. They indicate that Brigham Young had a voice for every purpose and support the claim of his 1855 discourse that he was entirely in control of his written presentation. When he chose a particular tone for a given letter, he intended the letter to convey exactly that tone. This paper explores a few of the Brigham Young voices to be found in the vast collection of his preserved correspondence. A great deal of Brigham Young's correspondence involves instruction or counsel to individual saints and bears a collegial tone. Dear brother, so soon as grass and the snow in the mountains will permit, say from the middle of April to 1st of May next, a small company of elders will leave here upon missions to Europe. Should it be consistent with your feelings and circumstances, we should be pleased to have you go with them, probably to France, to be under the direction of the presidency in the British Isles. Please inform me by the first opportunity how this proposition meets your views and feelings. Some letters are sterner, dealing with peculiar circumstances. To one man requesting permission to take a plural wife, he wrote, I would gladly bless you agreeable to request, if you would take a course to retain such blessings after they are conferred upon you. But you are naturally inclined to be a little wild and to draw away from settlements to places unpleasant and unsafe. I am of the opinion that it will be altogether best for you to continue to lead the life of a hermit, for I know of no woman worth a groat who would be willing to agree with your wild, unsocial ways. Other letters are unmistakably tender, intended to comfort and encourage. Beloved sister, your letter of the 12th October is received, communicating the mournful intelligence of the death of your husband and asking counsel on various topics. I feel to sympathize with you and give you all the information which you ask and your situation requires in the absence of your companion and counselor. Sister Staley, you must not be cast down or discouraged. You are now suffering a day of trial, and if you endure as a wise handmaid, you shall come off victorious. Your loss will be restored in the morn of the resurrection, and your union and joy will be without end. Therefore, be patient, walk humble and submissive, and perform every duty devolving upon you, and it shall be well with you, whether in prosperity or adversity, in time or in eternity, for you shall be blessed. Such letters are not at all unexpected from a man in Brigham Young's position, but other letters take me by surprise for their utter lack of pastoral concern. A northern Utah man who had donated all his livestock to the church in a time of its need, and who then found himself the sole support of 8 family members when his son-in-law died in the service of the church, wrote to Brigham Young to ask for the gift of enough beef cattle to support the family until he could raise a crop. Without a single word of encouragement, nor any acknowledgement of the family's contributions and sacrifices, Brigham Young replied, As soon as we receive any beef cattle, we will let you have some. Your brother in the gospel, Brigham Young. Another type of letter, just as surprising, but more pleasantly so, is that written with no purpose other than to soothe the ruffled feathers of saints who had taken offense where no offense was intended. An extreme example of this type of letter is one written to a Lehigh man in 1860. Brigham Young could so easily have ignored the complaints or scolded the man for whining, but instead he wrote an extraordinary reply of more than 800 words, which is an extremely long letter compared to most in the collection. Sir, your lengthy letter of the 18th instant came safe to hand and has been perused. It is supposable that you have seen enough years and people in your probationary time to give you a thorough understanding that there is a great variety of tastes and temperaments in the human family. So long as that variety continues, and I am not aware that you and I can altogether prevent it, so long different persons will view the same matters in more or less of a different light and arrive at very diverse conclusions from very variable premises. There is also a feeling, for some reason rather more common in small settlements than in large, to know somewhat more about their neighbors' affairs than their own. With many, there is also a disposition to restlessness under the authorities appointed, deeming, perhaps, that if they themselves had control, all matters would work to a tidy charm, and that their dictation would be so superlatively full of wisdom that all trials, crosses, and vexations would be well-nigh blotted out from this state of probation, and every matter, operation, plan, feeling, and work, whether public or private, would so nicely, wisely, and lovingly work into and with every other that heaven would be upon earth. Although the contents can be summarized as mind your own business, the letter is courteous throughout. It is one that the recipient no doubt showed proudly to his neighbors as evidence that he was on intimate terms with at least one great man. One large subset of Brigham Young correspondence might be classed as prodding the saints to do their duty. Within this subset, a full range of tones exists, suggesting that Brigham Young adapted his voice to the requirements of each saint's circumstances. At one end of that range are the letters that assume duty will be met when once it is pointed out. Sister Sarah Hyatt, claiming to be your wife, has written to me that you had not done as you promised her about emigrating her and your son by a former wife. She also states that she would have been able to have emigrated herself had she not expended a good share of her earnings in support of your son. Will you be so kind as to at once take the right steps in this matter? To a returned missionary whose duty in a similar circumstance was not quite so undeniable, Brigham Young offered a few words of inducement. I have letters before me in which I find statements concerning some promises you made while in England. Neither urge any claim upon you further than your voluntary promises, but upon reflecting upon the contents of their letters, it occurred to me that fulfilling your promises to those brethren would not only be keeping your word, but tend greatly to strengthen your faith through assisting in gathering the poor. Please inform me, at your earliest convenience, of your views and intentions in relation to your promises. Trusting that in your plenty of this world's goods, you will conclude to aid one or both the families aforenamed to deliver themselves from Babylon, I remain your brother in the gospel. Moving further along the scale, from friendly suggestion toward outright fiat, we find that Brigham Young could apply a gentle dose of guilt to encourage a desired response. Brother Thomas Williams informs me that he has brought your sister, who is a cripple, to this valley, and supported her since her arrival at this place. I am informed that she is the only sister you have in the valley, and I must confess that it looks strange to see that, being as well off as you are, you should permit anyone else than yourself to provide for her. Indeed, if I am rightly informed, you have scarcely visited her since her arrival. Poverty itself would scarcely excuse such neglect, much less the more favorable circumstances with which high heaven has blessed you. Extend, therefore, a portion wherewith the Lord has bestowed upon you to the comfort, consolation, and support of your own sister, that she may feel that she has a brother who feels an interest for her. So shall you be able to render a better account of your stewardship to the master of the vineyard. In some cases, appeals to reason and justice do not seem to have satisfied Brigham Young, and his counsel grew stronger and more pointed. Yet still he remained within the bounds of brotherly advice. Dear brother, from various sources I learned that you abused the privileges granted you by the legislature in taking toll for the repair and construction of certain bridges. I regret to say to you that you are ruining yourself for the sake of a paltry dollar. Cease your operations forthwith. Remember that privileges are given to use and not abuse, and that you not only injure yourself but discredit the community in which you live. Receive a word of kind remonstrance from a friend who would rejoice in your well-doing. Hoping to hear from this time forth a more favorable account of your doings, I remain, as ever, very truly, your undeviating friend and brother in the unity of the faith. And finally, in a relatively few extreme examples, Brigham Young's tone becomes angry and threatening, as in this missive to the Bishop of Springville. I made a public call in your place yesterday for some fat cattle to take to Walker, which has not been suitably responded to. I was in earnest in making the call, and fully expected that it would have been answered without delay. I now renew the call in a different way. Get some men with horses and go take any fat cattle that you can find and send them on. If the people complain, ask them what they are going to do about it. I know what I am going to do in all such cases. I will not cherish such brethren as brethren or friends, but treat them as aliens. Aliens from wholesome laws and good order. Aliens from the Society of Latter-day Saints and their own professions of the faith. Aliens from God and salvation. I have borne it long enough. It is an insult to God, to his holy priesthood, to holy angels and all good men, for pretended brethren to hold up their hands unto high heaven and witness before God that they will sustain me and my brethren in presiding over them, and then turn right around and treat with neglect and disdain our reasonable requests and counsel. I am righteously angry at such things, but forbear to say more at present. You laugh. Not all of Brigham Young's correspondence, of course, was written to direct the affairs of the saints or the kingdom. A great many letters were written merely to inform those absent from home and to acknowledge the hundreds of reports received from missionaries, business agents, political representatives, and others laboring down in the world. In reflecting upon the situation of those brethren who are abroad upon missions, and realizing from experience many of their feelings, it occurred to my mind that a few lines from Utah might be a benefit, comfort, and consolation to you in your labors. Dear brother, your welcome favor of July 3rd came safe to hand and was perused with much interest. While it encourages the saints abroad to learn of our progress in Utah, it is also cheering to us to hear that they are striving for the enjoyment of that spirit that leadeth unto life and are laboring with their mights for their deliverance from Babylon. Such letters to those absent from Utah are filled with news of crops, city improvements, the general health of the people, weather, theatricals, and other items of local gossip. They are much like the letters Brigham Young wrote to his own absent sons, with which we are familiar through Dean Jesse's 1974 work. The tone is invariably one of cheerful, folksy good humor, with an occasional flash of wit. The public works are steadily progressing. The tabernacle is being plastered, and the digging for the foundation for the wall around the temple block is progressing. The winter has been very mild, so much so that for the past 3 weeks, the people have been sowing wheat and planting their gardens. I contemplate taking a trip south soon after conference to seek a location for a settlement over the rim of the basin where it is considered that cotton, if not sugarcane, will flourish. Since I last wrote to you, nothing of very grave or serious import has transpired in our mountain home. The army remains quietly encamped in Cedar Valley, enjoying ample opportunity for perfecting lack of discipline. Such displays of sarcasm and other forms of humor become very frequent in letters written to close friends, men like William H. Hooper, George Q. Cannon, and John M. Bernheisel. I have just learned that there are some 30 sacks of mail matter at the Muddy Station, many of the papers and pamphlets lying around loose. Such not carrying the mail would hardly be tolerated on any other route, but such conduct toward Utah may entitle the contractors to even extra pay for their steady perseverance in not delivering the mail matter entrusted to them on the frontiers. Dear brother, your most welcome favors came duly to hand. I am pleased with your course, and I entertain no doubt but that you are doing all that any person could do under the circumstances. I don't expect Congress to do much to benefit Utah if they know it and can help it. I have, in a previous letter, expressed my feelings to you upon this subject. All I wish to say further to you at present is to remember the 13th commandment, "Fret not thy gizzard because of sinners." When writing to such intimate friends, Brigham Young may not have always exercised quite the same caution he claimed in his 1855 discourse. One letter to John M. Bernheisel records Brigham Young's anger at the unquestioning acceptance Congress accorded the claims of mountaineer Jim Bridger against Brigham Young. His frustration mounts as he expresses it, and I imagine his voice grew louder and louder as he dictated. "You wish me to keep you posted in such matters transpiring here as would be likely to create any stir there. Of course I endeavor to keep you informed, but it would pass the bounds of the most visionary dreams to imagine that a man of Bridger's appearance, ignorance, and folly could have any influence with the professed wise men of our nation. They would doubtless be pleased to have us allow horse thieves, adulterers, ravishers, delinquent taxpayers, in short, lawbreakers of every grade, roam at large in our midst, and even bow and scrape to them, and invite them into our houses, and say to them, 'You are good and true men, aye, gentlemen,' for fear they might ride or run to Washington. Please say to all who advocate such policy, 'Kiss my ass, damn you.'" " In fairness, I have to admit that that phrase appears only in the rough draft and was replaced by a more circumspect, less entertaining sentence in the when it went out. Such is not true in the case of the taunting letter he wrote pseudonymously to Stephen A. Douglas in 1861, or the vulgar letter he suggested William H. Hooper write anonymously to Judge John Cradlebaugh in 1860. I'll give you those references, but I'm not going to read those. Another friend to whom Brigham Young felt free to express himself in intimate, albeit more gentlemanly terms than the last set of quotations, was Thomas L. Kane. To our dear friend, Colonel Kane, our friend, a title than which we can give no greater, permit me to congratulate you upon the lively and joyous addition to your family, and please accept my warmest wishes that heaven's choice blessings may attend your daughter during her sojourn in this time. Most truly do I rejoice with you and your dear lady. You can appreciate my sentiments on this point, for you are more or less aware of the high estimation in which I hold children as a blessing. May yours richly prove so and be multiplied to your heart's desire. In contrast to the extended intimate correspondences with such friends, Brigham Young engaged in countless brief exchanges with Gentiles who wrote to him with business proposals or queries about conditions in Utah, Brigham Young's religious opinions, and mundane matters of every description. On such occasions, he was normally cordial, if brief. Sympathizing with you in the loss of your collection of autographs and commending your energy and perseverance in making a new collection, agreeable to your request of May 29th, I herewith forward to you the autograph of Brigham Young. From time to time, recognizing that a query regarding the means and methods of reaching Utah was a barely disguised solicitation of a handout, he could be curt. The best route is across the plains from the east. To those who wrote to request a brief statement of Mormon doctrines, he might write that they were faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, repentance of sin, baptism by one having authority from heaven for the remission of sin, the laying on of hands for the gift of the Holy Ghost, and then a blameless walk in obedience to the commandments of Israel's God. Trusting that my reply to your request has been brief enough not to weary you, I am respectfully Brigham Young. To one who inquired more sincerely about religious matters, Brigham Young would engage in a respectful explication of Mormon beliefs with a cordial invitation to carry on the correspondence, either with Brigham Young himself or with some other church leader whom he would designate. You state, "It's the life we live, not the ism." It is very true that the purest professions, without corresponding practice, can avail but little towards a person's salvation, for it is truly written, "Faith without works is dead." It is equally true that the Creator had a wise design and, as the Father of our spirits, had a right to devise a plan to enable His children to regain His presence. If such be the case, it follows that the observance of any other plan will cause a person to come more or less short of the kingdom of our God. Of course, you are at as full liberty to prefer spiritualistic notions as I am to choose the gospel. Had the time for this session been three times as great, we could have sampled the distinctive voices Brigham Young used in other circumstances. His extreme attention to detail when writing about business matters, his nostalgic tone when corresponding with old friends not seen since youth, his respectful tone to politicians whom he was not at the moment intending to offend, the evolution of his tone in correspondence with Indian leaders, beginning with the embarrassingly patronizing and growing into terms of respect. Those voices, as well as a fuller examination of the ones we have touched on here, await anyone who wishes to take advantage of the correspondence now open to the public at LDS Archives. Anyone who does so, of course, will find personal favorites among the incredible, rich source of our history. I would be hard put to identify a single favorite letter among the outgoing correspondence, but if allowed more than one, I would choose the extended correspondence between Brigham Young and his friend William H. Hooper. Wherein I see the clearest picture of Brigham Young as a whole man, one whom I could admire and enjoy, at least from a safe distance. I have very much enjoyed the past few months where I have felt almost like a clerk at Brigham Young's office, reading his mail and taking his dictation, and I look forward to many more months of listening to the voices of Brigham Young.
And had an Yes, yes. Yeah, most of the letters were dictated. I mean, he didn't write, I don't think he wrote that much actually in his own hand, as I'm aware. Very, very little correspondence. The overwhelming majority were written by clerks. But we'll get to that. In the question and answer period. I just want to mention that if my comments seem a bit disjointed and maybe not as well as polished as they should be, I didn't receive this paper until late Tuesday night. And so I was just in kind of a panic mode, both reading and digesting the paper and trying to, figure out how to organize my remarks. Thank goodness I had some, a fairly good prior knowledge of Brigham Young, having written my own biography. And the thing that I panicked the most on was, let me read what was written on the folder. Kilo, no, this further sent me into panic mode. Newell, artist said, this is not the final version. That's always the scary part on these things. But at least you will know where she is headed. And I've been in those situations before, and they can be very embarrassing. Here you've got a whole complete rewrite. But to artist's credit, she really didn't modify or change that much from the version of the paper that she gave me. I think there are a couple of three places that I noted as I was following the text in my thing, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate that you maintain the integrity and the flavor of the paper as it was given to me late Tuesday night. So I guess my comments will still have some relevance. I found Artis's presentation especially engaging and informing, as I suggest, given my own experience in researching the life and times of Brigham Young, which resulted in my own book-length biography on the Mormon Leader, published back in 1986. Most people aren't even aware that I wrote a book because, see, it came out in the wake, in the big wake of Leonard Arrington's magnum opus. And he said, oh, you wrote a Brigham Young biography? I thought that had already been done. But anyway, it's kind of been forgotten. Although I still point out that it's still in print. It was published by Little Brown originally, and then it went to Longman, and that's who's publishing it now. I mean, they absorbed Little Brown, and it's continuously been in print since 1986. So it's available if you want to. I'm not trying here to plug books or anything, but if you want to pick up a copy of it, it is. And I think I offer a somewhat different perspective on Brigham Young than what Leonard Arrington did. I agree with a lot of his conclusions, but it's a slightly different approach. But the book exists, and it's still in print. In this regard, moving on, I'm heartened by, encouraged by the fact, getting back to Artis's paper, that she was given access to Brigham Young's correspondence. Because back when I was doing research on this biography, start back in the early 1980s, access was extremely restricted, virtually non-existent, in sharp contrast to the more open access I'd had a decade earlier. The decade earlier when I had done my first book on Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, I had access to virtually everything. They brought out whole boxes. I mean, they brought out the holograph. I mean, they brought out these valuable documents. They hadn't put them on microfilm or whatever. It was when they were down on 47 South Temple before they'd moved into the new facility, and actually before Leonard Arrington had become a church historian. And they brought me everything I asked for. I couldn't believe how open they had become. The only thing they required when I went in there was an interview. And I didn't have the heart to tell them, or the guts to tell them I was working on the Mormon Black issue, which was a very hot topic at that time, a very sensitive topic because it was prior to the lifting of the priesthood ban. I gave them some mealy-mouthed title. I'm working on Mormon response to national questions, great national issues, or something like that. And I didn't want to tell them, well, I'm dealing with the restrictive policy that you have toward blacks. I mean, I thought that would just slam the doors completely. But nevertheless, they brought out everything I'd asked for back in the 1970s. But by the early 1980s, this had completely reversed. And they were really starting to shut everything down. And I was really discouraged when I went up there and I talked, I think it was to Jim Kimball, who some of you, not Jim Kimball who's doing the biography of Jay Golden who spoke, but Jim Kimball who was, I think, the librarian at the church historical department. He says, well, I can't let you have access to open access like you had earlier. You have to tell me exactly what letter you want and what you want, what is in there that you want to look at. I mean, that's how restrictive it had become by the early 1980s. And it was really discouraging because the only way I managed to get this biography written was I had access to the Donald R. Moorman papers. Donald R. Moorman had done a great deal of research, the late professor at Weber State. And I was given access to those materials, and that served, you know, I couldn't check footnotes or I couldn't check the original letters or anything else. I had to kind of go on faith in quoting from the materials that I used. And Jeff Johnson pointed me to some very, very valuable materials about Brigham Young and polygamy, which I'm always forever grateful. And there were other people that helped me to stitch it together. So I had to sort of work around the fact that the materials that were originally available to me back in the 1970s and that artists has said that has been available to her were not at all available to me. And I guess she can go into more detail about this. A couple of questions I have is, were you granted similarly unlimited access, or were you was your access limited to certain select correspondence? And I guess the same would be true for things like diaries and office journals and stuff like that. I'm sure you'll enlighten the audience more to that during the question and answer period. But that I think that's a question that's in everybody's mind. But moving on, like artists, I was also struck by the variety and the tone in Brigham Young's letters, his so-called many voices. A more critical observer might say, dub it maybe the many faces, of depending on who he was corresponding with. Parshall's narrative is really engaging and interesting. I found it really flowed nicely, and it was well-structured, well-organized. It was a real pleasure to read it. It somewhat compensated for the fact of the lateness of how I got it, because the version that you gave here today, you could see that you had engaged the audience very well. So you really, it was well crafted in presenting to that. On the one side, you were able to give us a flavor for the tender, compassionate Brigham Young, comforting Hannah Staley, the Mormon widow who had just lost her husband. On the other extreme, you have the angry, threatening, sometimes vulgar Brigham Young, on occasion threatening the use of violence. You're correct in saying that this is the Brigham Young that you're really drawn to. Because there's such salty quotes, some of them, and such salty comments coming from him. Just like the one you said, let him intrude upon the chastity of my family. By so help me God, I'll use them up. He seemed to like to, threaten violence, and that raises a whole, in the wake of the Jim Bridger incident, and the other quote you mentioned about the vulgar expression, they can kiss my ass, at the end of, that really. I came across one when I was doing my Brigham Young biography that was even more earthy than that, when he was, describing Governor Stephen J. Harding, and I used it in my book, and it's in the 1860s. I mean, this governor comes from Indiana, kind of a Hoosier hotshot, and he's comes out here to govern the Mormons, and at first it looks like he's going to be a good governor, but he ends up really, being another one of these. People that develops a dislike for the Mormons, and so he and Brigham Young clash, and then there's this little correspondence that he says, and this thing that you have that calls himself governor, if you were to fill a sack with cow shit, it would be the best thing you could do for an imitation, and that would be just as good as he is. You know, so you know, you're really naturally drawn to those kind of quotes, you know, those are fun quotes. But Parshall, to her credit, has presented a diverse variety of quotes in suggesting that Brigham Young is much more complex than that. He's a complex, multifaceted individual. And I found the same thing when I got into my biography, because I'll be honest with you, when I started to do Brigham Young, I approached him kind of negatively. I was much more negatively disposed because I had done The Saints, Slaves, and Blacks. And I'll be honest, I won't mince any words here. He was a virulent racist in many ways, particularly in his attitudes toward blacks. He had this real visceral, almost disdain for black people, much, you know, and you compare that with what, you know, with, and you might want to come to the session where I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. Later in the day, we're going to be dealing with the black issue, but I developed a very negative reaction to Brigham Young, and on the basis of the research when I did The Saints, Slaves, and Blacks. But as I got into the biography, like artists, I found that this guy had a lot more there than first meets the eye. That this guy was a complex, multifaceted, a very well organized, very intelligent, very articulate, you know, in his own way, in his own rough-hewn frontier sort of way. There was a certain articulateness to Brigham Young, and some of the letters that artists quoted sort of reflect that. There was the aspect of Brigham Young, he could be out there with one tone of voice giving instruction or counsel, and he could calibrate the letters, as artists have said, to whom he was writing, whom he was addressing them to, and how public that information. This really reflects. That was particularly evident in the letter you quoted on the letter you wrote to the individual who the ruffled feathers of the saint who had taken offense. You know, I thought that was kind of really a clever letter. I mean, it's a very, very very sophisticated letter. I think you have to confess that. Although I found, I enjoyed and found Parshall's artist's presentation engaging and most interesting, there were a number of loose ends and places where I felt it could have been a little bit better developed. For example, in discussing the letters written to so-called close friends, I guess I shouldn't say so-called because, a Hooper was an intimate, but all of these people that she mentioned as close friends, they were not just simply close friends. The people she mentions are not only Hooper, but John M. Bernheisel and George Q. Cannon. They were in a very special position because most letters he wrote to these three individuals, it was when they were serving as Utah territorial delegate back in Washington, D.C., and that makes those letters not simply valuable because he was writing them as close friends, but because they were reflecting on issues affecting the saints and relations with the federal government at that time, trying to walk that tightrope of expressing chagrin at the way that that they were being treated at various times, and these people all served, from the period of the 1850s. I think that's when Bernheisel was there. Hooper was there in the late 50s, early 60s, and Cannon, as I recall, was there in the late 60s and into the 70s. And this was an extremely critical time, an extremely tense time, during the Utah War, the dispatch of Patrick Edward Connor, who to Utah certainly was no friend of the Saints, and the coming down of all of this anti-polygamy legislation. And then at the same time, all of these less than competent federal officials being sent out to Utah. It's interesting because, Brigham Young always lamented about, what boobs and how incompetent a lot of these people were, and almost like they were discriminating against the saints, but there were incompetent federal officials who were sent to virtually every territory. It seemed like that's where they got that's where they sent the riffraff. People that couldn't measure up for a regular appointment in Washington, D.C., They were given territorial appointments out in the boondocks. There was sort of a pattern there, and so it was no accident. It wasn't because the Mormons, oh, they're Mormons, we're going to give them this real crappy people. But you know, they were sending not the best people to other territories as well. Along this line, it might be true that Young's letters maintained a respectful tone to politicians whom he was not at the moment intending to offend. But I think it's safe to say that, on the whole, Brigham Young appeared to have a minimal amount of respect for most U.S. government officials for the reasons that I've just mentioned. I also have to confess that in going through a paper, partial is sometimes a little bit of a tease, you know. she kind of made reference to this. What was it in the taunting letter to Stephen A. Douglas? I'm kind of curious about it, because I've always had an interest in Douglas, because Douglas had an ambivalent relationship with the Mormons. In the 40s, when they were back in Illinois, he appeared to be their friend, and he worked with them. When he got in the 1860s, or 1850s, when he was running for president, he referred to, polygamy as a cancer that had to be excised from the body politic. And the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints, like to refer back to an alleged statement that Joseph Smith made to Stephen Douglas. If you ever turn on the saints, you'll never fulfill your ambitions to be president of the United States. Something to that effect. So I'd be interesting to know what was in that taunting letter to Stephen A. Douglas, or even more so, the vulgar letter, where he suggested that William H. Hooper write George Cradlebaugh in 1860. So there's a little bit of a tease there. Also, Artis's brief reference to Young's correspondence with Indian chiefs, her statement, as evolving from embarrassing patronizing and growing in terms of respect, I think is also a bit of an overstatement, and indeed an oversimplification of the complex nature of Young's attitudes and related behavior toward the Native American inhabitants of the Great Basin. On the one hand, there is Young's often quoted statement that it is better to feed the Indians than to fight them. You know, we hear that oftentimes. It sort of sums up, Brigham Young's attitudes toward the Indians. But that's also an oversimplification, because in reality, Young promoted a complex policy of befriending the Indians and attempting to convert them to Mormonism, while at the same time promoting Mormon settlements, which frequently encroached on their lands, forcing the Indians on to regional reservations. Indeed, the larger topic of Mormon-Indian relations remains to be researched and written. You know, that's a topic. I'm surprised that's a real lacuna, a real void in the area of Mormon studies. But thanks to the now availability of Brigham Young's correspondence as Indian commissioner, and I guess in other capacities, such a history, hopefully at long last, can be written. And just one final set of questions that kind of goes back where I started at the beginning. What Brigham Young materials are actually available, and to whom? And what restrictions are there on their access and use in written published works? I guess maybe that's a good place to start as a response. But as I say, I really enjoyed this paper, and I really applaud what she did. Okay.
Just a little bit of a response. The two difficulties with a paper like this is that if I was going to quote from a variety of things, I had to find letters where Brigham Young said something very briefly, made the point that way. There are lots of other letters where we could have gone on, couldn't make the point without reading a couple of pages. The patronizing letter to the Indians was one of those examples. It really goes on as, "Dear Indians, we your friends, you bad Indians, be good Indians, we bless you, signed Big Chief." And the more respectful tones are later on when he's getting... we understand there's been some difficulty. This is how we want to resolve it. I mean, he's talking to them more as human beings. The other difficulty is that I was talking... I'm trying to illustrate the voices that he used, which is pretty much apart from the content. Some of the letters that I quoted were pretty trivial, but they illustrated a point of the kind of voice that he used. There are tens of thousands of letters that are available. The part of the collection that is now open to the public is the correspondence. It doesn't include the diaries or the account books or so on. The same restrictions are still in place there. If you know that something exists and you can write a request, you can pin down what you need and justify why you need to see that, why something else won't do, then it's the same access that they've had all along. All of the incoming correspondence is available to the public. The outgoing correspondence is a little bit difficult. Anything that is loose is available. That includes all of the rough drafts that were preserved, a lot of loose correspondence to the men that were back in Washington. Trying to think. There are a lot of classes, letters that were written to specific people that are available. The outgoing correspondence, for the most part, is still restricted because it's in bound books, but it's a lot easier now to identify a letter that Brigham Young wrote that you want to see because you've got half of the correspondence already. Before, you were in the dark. Is there a letter that has to do with slavery? Well, I don't know. I don't know who it is. You have to give a date and a name, and you don't know. But if you find an answer that William Crosby wrote telling about the difficulties that two of his slaves were causing for each other, and then you can request the letter in response and find out that Brigham Young was considering buying one of them. So it's a lot easier to pin down the letter that you want now. Yeah. I have never yet been denied access to anything that I've asked for from the collection. It's only a matter of identifying what it is that you want through sources that are available. Well, I don't have that honor. So, any questions? The outgoing... Oh, she's asking why the archives handles things that way. The outgoing correspondence that is in bound books also includes an awful lot of letters of a confidential nature, excommunications and so on, and they can't give you the book and say, look at page 2, but don't look at page 3. So what they do is if you identify that you want a particular letter, Ron Watt will go through and Xerox that copy, that page, and let you look at it. Eventually, I should think that they'd go through and provide photocopies of all the pages that are okay, and make those available, but not yet. Yes? The question. The question is, did he write some things that were as inflammatory as some of the things that he gave from the pulpit? I think I addressed that in the beginning of my paper, where I quoted him as saying that words are wind. Once they're spoken, they're gone, and he will act and speak as he pleases. But he when he commits something to writing, that can be passed around and printed, and this is the word of Brigham Young. See, it's in his own handwriting. Then he was a lot more careful. And that's pretty much the intent of my paper, is to show that he was very careful when he wrote. He could control himself when he wanted to. He recognized the importance of controlling himself when he put it on paper. Therefore, when you read a letter and it is angry or helpful or whatever, you better take that into consideration. He was trying to accomplish something by that tone. It wasn't an accident. whereas when he's speaking from the pulpit, he said what he pleased, just like he said. Take him at his word there. Yes? You mean over time or between the rough draft and the final? How much difference was there? The rough drafts are very heavily edited. They're a little bit hard to read because I suspect that he would ask the clerk to read back to him, and there are a lot of overstrikes, a lot of inserts. One thing that did strike me with the rough drafts is only in one case did I find he wrote a lot of letters to a lot of people on the same day. And a lot of them said pretty much the same thing. But only in one case did he ever say, send this to Mr. A and Mr. B. He wrote individual letters. And so sometimes when he'd say the same news about what was going on in Salt Lake for the sixth time that day, either it would get briefer and briefer, or he'd get more and more sarcastic, depending on the way he was going. He had a little practice. He'd sharpened it. But most of the corrections were made on the rough drafts, and the difference between that and the fair copy is not all that different. Was Brigham Young aware that a lot of his speeches were being recorded, and so was he aware of how harsh they were? He had no excuse not to know. John M. Bernheisel wrote a wonderful letter. He was always trying to steer Brigham Young into behaving himself a little bit, but he was always so respectful. Dear brother, I would respectfully suggest that in this case you might consider picking, you know, and he warned him that whatever he said was being repeated, that it was coming back to Washington and it was causing trouble. So please, at least if it's going to be published in the Deseret News, talk to the editor so that he only prints things that you don't mind having come east, because people are recording it and it's arriving.
Oops. In doing my research, I remember I went through all of the John Bernheisel correspondence that was available, and the correspondence going back and forth between Brigham Young and Bernheisel, and I had the impression that Bernheisel was a pretty cautious, circumspect. I knew he was trained as a physician or a surgeon, whereas Hooper, it seemed like there was more of a freewheeling. I don't know if that's the impression that you got in the letters that went, because I examined all that correspondence very carefully when I was doing.
A lot of the letters to Hooper are a lot more...
They're more open, more spontaneous.
Yeah, partly because he's responding. Hooper always tells him, I think we're going to have trouble. This is about to happen, and we better prepare. And Brigham Young would respond to the possibility that there was going to be trouble. With Bernheisel was pretty sharp, and he didn't tell Brigham Young that there was a problem until after it had happened and he'd already taken care of it.
I don't think they did. I think there's some of them. I think a good number of them. But when I was looking at the race issue, there were several of them. I know there were a number that were considered too explosive, or maybe they just decided not to put them in there. But that was going to lead to a question I wanted to ask.
I agree with you. There were some letters that came back from mission.
Discourses. These are sermons and journal discourses.
Yeah, there were some letters that came back and forth where Brigham Young was surprised to see something come out in the Journal of Discourses because it hadn't been published in Salt Lake first. So, yes.
I used to work at the Lion House.
Is Brigham Young patronizing when it comes to dealing with federal officers? Yeah.
I think Young was also, I think he was more sagacious a lot of times than people give him credit for. I think on the one hand, he would lash out at these people, maybe in public discourses and stuff like that. And he made some reference, and I wish I had the quote in front of me, about this member that I have the most trouble controlling is my mouth or something like that. He said that, and I can't remember, but he was aware that he had a tendency to be much less circumspect when he was addressing a congregation or getting in front of a group. And so he would say some awfully intemperate things about federal officers. And just like that one that you mentioned, that one letter that he cut out when he sent the letter about, you know, kissing my ass, you know. I mean, he cuts that out of the final draft. But in the reality of the situation, he knew that he had, you know, there would be repercussions if he went too far in making such statements, and that would explain why you would retract something like that in the final draft of the letter.
One last thing that I'd like to say about the correspondence, encouraging people to go up there and use it, is we're drawn to the outgoing correspondence because this is Brigham Young talking, and this is the voice of the church, and he's such a fascinating man, and so on. But don't neglect the incoming correspondence. I think that is the most marvelous collection I can imagine. He's getting reports from everybody, everywhere, telling what's going on, who they're seeing, what's happening, what life is like, all over the church. It's from local, I mean, Philo Farnsworth's writing from Beaver. You know exactly what's going on and who's having trouble and what school teacher they do or don't have and so on. But he's also getting reports from Washington, from the mission headquarters, from missionaries all over the world. So don't neglect the incoming. I think that in many ways, that is far more valuable than Brigham Young's outgoing correspondence. Yes?
I'm thinking of any way of knowing which of the comments he gave were actually approved by him before they went to trial. This was whenever he made the statement that anything he said over the pulpit, as long as it was approved by him before it went right, is considered scripture.
The question is, how do we know which of Brigham Young's talks were approved by him before they were printed? I don't know the answer. There are a few letters that complain about specific talks, so I could say in those cases they weren't approved. But I haven't dealt with speeches. I've just been working with the correspondents.
Thank you so much all for coming, and I hope you really enjoyed it. I did. The tape for this session is also will be available out at the table out here if you would like to get any of those. And thank you so much for coming.